Today is Wednesday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. More than 100 million people have contracted the virus responsible for COVID-19. Now, at least four variants have been detected. What still don't we know about the disease?
Infectivity rates and mortality, but are any of them more prone to triggering certain kinds of immune responses?
Plus, an exclusive interview with Malawi's recently departed president. We'll have these stories and more next. As the world surpasses 100 million confirmed COVID-19 infections, it's dealing with multiple variants of the original coronavirus that began the pandemic. New coronavirus variants have been discovered in Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and in the western U.S. state of California. Dr. Zach Jenkins is an associate professor of pharmacy practice with Cedarville University and clinical infectious disease expert with Premier Health in Cedarville, Ohio. I began our conversation by asking him, what do we know about these new strains?
So I think the first thing to understand is that as this pandemic continues to roll onward, we will continue to see more variants. That's inevitable. It just so happens as we have more and more virus circulate and it produces more and more of itself, you start to see these little mutations, these offshoots occur. When it comes to looking at all of these, though, I think probably the way that we can kind of group them together are questions of, well, three big questions. Number one, first off, is it more infectious? And what we're seeing with some of these is that that is true. So the UK variant, for example, is about 70% more infectious than the COVID strain that's been pretty predominant in the United States. Another big question that comes up is, are these more fatal? And some, there's a little bit of debate, I would say, on some of these different elements. The UK B117, which is that variant we've heard a lot about from the United Kingdom, there's some reports suggesting that maybe it is a little bit more fatal than the strain we've had in the U.S. The third question, though, that I think we kind of have to wrap our heads around is, do these mutations impact our vaccination efforts? And so what's interesting is when you look at all these different variants, a lot of them actually have mutations of the spike protein, which is what, at least for the vaccines in the United States, we've been targeting for our primary vaccine methods. So to date, the good news is the vaccines seem to be holding out against the variants as far as what's been studied. We know that the Pfizer vaccine seems to be active against the South African strain and the UK strain. And the Moderna vaccine did show some activity as well, although they've actually noted that it was a little bit more blunted in their response with the South African variant. So what they're suggesting that they may do is create a booster shot where they can actually start to protect against these other variants. So that's going to be an ongoing discussion as we continue to see these different variants emerge.
Dr. Jenkins, you mentioned that you are not surprised that there have been different variants of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. There are also different strains of the seasonal flu. Is this something that is analogous to that?
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways in that, you know, the flu tends to emerge every year. We see a lot of different variants. And what we do with the vaccine is we typically predict the most likely variants that we'll see. As you're probably aware, many people are probably aware, the vaccine with the flu is typically not 100% successful. It's usually around 50% or maybe less. And the reason for that is there are so many variants, and the flu happens to mutate very rapidly. The nice thing about the COVID virus in comparison is that it doesn't mutate quite as quickly. But even so, we're still seeing these mutants emerge.
So that's what we know about the coronavirus variants. In your opinion, where are our knowledge gaps? What don't we know?
It's a great question. I think there's some big questions we have to kind of think about with these variants, not only with infectivity rates and mortality, but are any of them more prone to triggering certain kinds of immune responses? So it's kind of expanding on that question in mortality. You know, we've known, for example, with COVID that it does cause a lot of blood clots. One thing we might start to ask ourselves as well, are any of these variants worse when it comes to that? Do the symptoms appear in greater frequency with certain variants than with others? So those are things we'll have to think about. And why that's an important question for us is it will drive drug development. It'll drive our therapeutic efforts. With the new variants emerging too, from a research perspective, we have to dive back in with the vaccines we have developed to test them and make sure that they are still efficacious against these things. And in some cases, we actually may have to supplement the vaccines we've already brought to market or make slight tweaks in them based on those results that we do find. We're getting a lot of concern that's arising with these variants, but to just to kind of assuage, I think, your listeners, Paul Offit, who is an infectious disease physician and also a member of the FDA's vaccine advisory panel, he's come out with a statement about how he's only mildly concerned with these variants as far as our vaccination efforts go. So we have hope on that horizon still, and I think we're still in a good position when it comes to that.
That was Cedarville University Assistant Professor Dr. Zach Jenkins, an infectious disease expert with Premier Health Partner. For most of the past year, Africa appeared to be doing better in containing the coronavirus pandemic than many wealthier nations. However, as South Africa and several other nations on the continent undergo a surge in infections, many experts think Africa's lower numbers may actually reflect lower testing rates, systemic underreporting, and other factors. VOA's Adam Phillips has more.
Professor Jaap Boom is the regional representative for Epicenter Africa, the research arm of Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières. Speaking from Cameroon, Boom said there are several reasons why COVID-19 statistics have tended to skew low on the continent.
To start with, most countries were actually targeting the people who had symptoms. While we've understood that in Africa, up to 80% of the positive COVID patients are asymptomatic. So there was a bunch of people that were not being screened because they were not asymptomatic.
Boom and his colleagues are trying to determine the actual prevalence of exposure to the virus by taking large numbers of blood samples in places like outdoor markets, large workplaces, and within extended families.
So we have started a survey in Congo, we'll be doing in Senegal, Cameroon, quite a number of other countries. And that will give us a better picture of how those countries have been affected.
The results have been sobering. For example, in Yaoundé, Cameroon's capital, the percentage of people known to have been exposed to the virus has risen 32%, while in Cape Town, South Africa, the number has soared as high as 60%. Those numbers dwarf the percentage of people testing positive on the PCR test, the most reliable test for active infection, and in antigen tests that detects coronavirus antibodies in the system, which indicates prior exposure. But many Africans are not being tested at all. That could be because they lack the transportation or the time to get to a health facility, or because many health facilities do not test for COVID-19 if a patient shows no symptoms, such as coughing, shortness of breath, fever, and the loss of taste or smell.
So even if a test is done, maybe the data doesn't get to the level it needs to for the reporting to happen.
Tiffany Harris is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center's ICAP Global Health Group in New York and the director of its Department of Strategic Information.
South Africa, which does have a much stronger surveillance system compared to the rest of the continent, we are seeing large number of cases, and we have for some time. That's probably also a sign that the other countries, there's undercounts there. In neighboring countries like Zimbabwe, for example, the cases are dramatically increasing there. And Zambia is also seeing a surge in cases.
Keeping reliable COVID infection rates is key, but so are accurate death records, which require testing, autopsies, and proper facilities. Many countries in Africa do not automatically register deaths. In those that do, registrations may be delayed months.
And so a common approach is to look at what often referred to as all-cause mortality. In the absence of something else that's going on, if we're seeing big rises in all-cause mortality over the same year, you could surmise that it's probably either direct effects of COVID or even indirect effects of COVID. And that's the other thing you have to keep in mind. If there's a countrywide lockdown and someone is not able to or is uncomfortable traveling to go seek care, they may not get a diagnosis or treatment. Even if it's not due to COVID, they might die because they're not getting care for other things. I think there's sort of the longer term fix that's needed of strengthening, you know, vital event system. There should be a real push right now to make sure every death is documented and the cause is identified to the extent possible.
Harris says that to gain control of the pandemic, Africa will need better surveillance and testing and rigorous contact tracing, along with lab support and the widespread distribution of vaccines. She adds that the recruitment of healthcare workers to educate the public and treat the sick is also crucial. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Virtual patients are stepping in for real ones and allowing nursing students to continue their training during the pandemic. Tina Trin has that story.
Do you ever get headaches?
Yeah, I get them a lot when I'm studying.
Tina Jones is a virtual patient, and you're her nurse. And to be a good one, you must ask the right questions, just like in the real world.
You would actually have to start the conversation.
David Messias is describing Shadow Health, a virtual training simulation for nurses and healthcare professionals. Recently acquired by health science publisher Elsevier, Shadow Health relies largely on what nurses in training say or write to patients.
That conversation engine truly evaluates how a student's effectiveness of interviewing, examining a patient through conversation.
Can you tell me more about your headaches?
When I get one, it's just kind of tight and throbbing.
The greatest strength, in my opinion, is the ability to ask an avatar a question and have them respond to you.
Lori Rilko teaches nursing students at George Washington University and says Shadow Health provides a safe environment in which students can practice and build their confidence.
They get to practice what questions to ask and how to ask it to get the information that's so crucial to make that diagnosis.
The virtual simulation includes a diverse set of patients with real-life symptoms.
They can listen to their heart and hear real heart sounds. They can look in their eyes and their ears.
Students learn to navigate sensitive discussions, too, like when signs of physical abuse are present. Shadow Health's technology lets students safely continue their education during the pandemic.
Brent Gordon is a managing director at Elsevier.
Not only just for the course-based instruction, but also for the clinical hour requirements that are necessary to become a registered nurse.
At a time when nurses are needed more than ever, virtual simulations are giving them the space to learn. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
In this exclusive interview with Malawi's recently departed president, Peter Mutharika speaks with VOA's Anita Powell about how South Africa's poorest nation is facing political troubles and the continued onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic.
Peter Mutharika is certain he won re-election last June in a poll which he insists was rigged and which triggered violent protests. But instead of pursuing his case through the courts, he invited the new president and his wife over for a chat and some coffee. Landlocked Malawi is Southern Africa's poorest nation and was rocked by political protests over the June poll, which was a redo of a February poll that courts invalidated. But after months of protests and challenges, Mutharika folded and says he'll never run for office again.
I thought we needed peace in this country after 11 months of violence. So that's what happened. And I think my people, I'm so glad that they acted responsibly and accepted that we should go on, let them take the government, and let Malawi go on in peace.
President Lazarus Chakwera acknowledged broadly some of his shortcomings late last year, saying he accepted criticism for his handling of the pandemic and other pressing issues.
Have you done enough? No, I will be the first one to tell you I have not done enough. And this country has not done enough.
One thing Chakwera's government was quick to do shortly after taking office was to freeze Mutharika's bank accounts amid a corruption investigation. The former president is accused of taking part in a $6 million scheme to illegally import cement. When asked about it by VOA, Mutharika denied his involvement in the purchase. Mutharika, who remains leader of the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, called out his rival for what he sees as his biggest stumble, dealing with coronavirus. He said the government has failed to provide enough tests and economic assistance for citizens affected by viral restrictions.
They need to do more. We probably need some kind of lockdown at some point. We also need to have resources to assist those families in terms of buying food, nutrition.
The former president did note the government is encouraging the use of face masks and urging people to social distance, steps he said were good for the fight against COVID-19. The 80-year-old statesman added that he would not hesitate to take the vaccine when it arrives in Malawi, which has yet to happen. And finally, Mutharika says he's encouraged by political change in a major donor nation, the U.S.
I've already seen President Biden reversing some of the things, going back to COP25, for example, and also getting United States back into the World Health Organization. So there are changes, and I assume that Africa, the previous government probably was not very active in Africa. I assume that perhaps the new government will be more active in Africa, as Democrats normally tend to do.
He did, however, offer some praise for the Trump administration, noting that Malawi was one of four countries that Melania Trump graced during her only tour of Africa in 2018. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists working on the Japanese radio astronomy project, VERA, have found that Earth is 2,000 light years closer to the Milky Way's galactic center and is orbiting it about 7 kilometers per second faster than thought. Residing near the galactic center is what scientists think is a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star. According to the UCLA Galactic Center Group, the giant black hole has a mass 4.6 million times that of the Sun and is about 150 million kilometers in size. Project Vera scientists say not to worry, though. Their findings don't mean Earth is getting ready to be sucked into the black hole. It's just because the data they gathered over 15 years of observations allowed them to create what they call a better model of our Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar's army warned on Tuesday that it would take action. The election dispute was not settled and declined to rule out staging a coup if its demands were not met. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Kate Diamond in Naypyidaw to get the details about the military's objections to the recent election.
They were trying to claim that, you know, one person was trying to vote in different places, you know, like not just one vote. So the military were trying to claim that, you know, they were election fraud, and the military was highlighting that they sent the several complaints to the government and the election commission, but at the same time, the government and the election commission are not taking responsible for it. So they said they will continue filing the complaint, and then they will do everything possible in line with the constitution and the existing law.
Cape, in that press conference, the military also said that they would not rule out taking action. What exactly did they mean by that?
We were not really clear what the military wanted to, you know, give the message. So there was the question about, you know, the possible coup, and that the exact question was, can we assume that, you know, you were not trying to say there's, you know, possible coup. The military spokesman said, yeah, maybe we can continue, you know, like filing the complaint in line with the constitution or the existing laws. So we were trying to, even like for the journalists, ourselves was trying to clarify the questions, you know, like clarify the answer with the military spokesman, you know, whether he would like to confirm that, you know, the military cannot guarantee for the possible, you know, coup. So still, we're still trying to figure it out.
So how did the government of Aung San Suu Kyi respond to those comments? And has the election commission responded to the allegations made by the military?
First, I have seen and I have observed there was no official response from, you know, either the government or the election commission. Because, yeah, even the press conference was finished around 3 or 4 p.m. local time. And, you know, We haven't seen any official response.
What about in the general public? Have they commented on the military's statements during the press conference?
And I was observing those response from the people, and the people were not really happy with this, the military comment, And, some people say that, this cannot be happened. We don't want to let this happen.
Cape Diamond is a reporter based in Myanmar. In India, a protest by tens of thousands of farmers erupted into chaos as many protesters breached the iconic Red Fort complex. As Anjana Pasricha reports, the farmers have been camped along highways on the outskirts of New Delhi for nearly 2 months, demanding the rollback of three contentious farm laws.
Mayhem gripped the Indian capital for hours on Tuesday after farmers swarmed into the heart of the city and clambered onto the ramparts of the historic Red Fort. Police fired tear gas shells, water cannons, and used batons to disperse the protesters. The farmers had been allowed to hold a unique rally and ride on thousands of tractors on the city's outskirts to mark their protest against three new farm laws. But some groups broke police barricades and entered central Delhi. At Red Fort, the protesters waved flags of farm unions and religious flags, and even hoisted some alongside the national flag. The historic building is of symbolic significance. This is from where the Prime Minister gives his annual Independence Day address. Shouting slogans against Prime Minister Narendra Modi, others tore through security barriers to march into central Delhi, where many government buildings are housed. Several prominent farm leaders said those who had breached the police barricades did not represent the majority. Farm leader Yugendra Yadav appealed to the farmers to return. He said, "We will only win if we conduct the protest peacefully. For 2 months, the entire nation and world has said that our strength is our peace. If we break this, we break our strength." At least one protester died and several police personnel were injured. Buses and police vehicles were damaged by protesters hurling stones. The chaos unfolded on Republic Day, which is marked with a military parade to mark the anniversary of India adopting its constitution. One farm union leader, Bhanu Pratap Singh, said antisocial elements had infiltrated the protests. Tens of thousands of angry farmers have been camped on Delhi's borders since late November, demanding the rollback of the three laws. The government says it will reform the agricultural sector, but farmers fear their livelihoods will be hurt. Sleeping in tractors, trucks and makeshift tents and cooking on the roadside, they have turned highways leading into the city into gigantic protest sites. Negotiations between the farmers and the government remain deadlocked. The government has offered to put the laws on hold for up to 18 months, but union leaders remain adamant that they must be repealed. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Greece and France have sealed a $2.8 billion deal for the purchase of 18 fighter jets for the Greek Air Force. The deal is part of a larger weapons purchase program that Greece is carrying out. This as Athens sits down to negotiate a solution to a growing dispute with Turkey over energy rights in the Eastern Mediterranean. Anthony Karasava reports.
The deal makes Greece the first European country to acquire the state-of-the-art Rafale jet fighters made by France's Dassault company. It is also the first major arms purchase Greece has made since it emerged from a 10-year financial crisis that imposed some of its most brutal budget cuts on its armed forces. Monday's agreement involves the purchase of 6 new and 12 used Rafale combat aircraft, the first batch of which will be delivered in July. All will come with fitted combat missiles. Greek combat pilots will also undergo special training in France. Nikos Panagiotopoulos, the country's defense minister, said the new warplanes would replace the country's aging fleet of French-made Mirage aircraft that Greece purchased almost 3 decades ago. France has long been a defense supplier to Greece. The choice of the Rafale planes, Panagiotopoulos says, reflects the strategic relations between Greece and France and the unyielding support that France continues to provide Greece. France has sided with Greece in the energy dispute with Turkey, challenging what Ankara maintained as its boundaries and drilling rights in the Aegean Sea and Eastern Mediterranean. Tensions have flared in recent months. Last year, France sent a frigate to the region and came dangerously close to having a confrontation with Turkish gunboats in disputed waters. Now Panagiotopoulos says that with the Rafales, Greece's air force will gain substantial superiority over the forces of its rival neighbor, Turkey. French Defense Minister Florence Parly was present at the signing ceremony in Athens. There she revealed that the Rafale deal is paving the way for additional purchases, including a number of French frigates. The two countries, she said, share many common values. She said they have a common conviction to face threats together, to provide for lasting and durable solutions. Greek Defense Ministry sources tell VOA Athens is exploring the prospect of purchasing at least four frigates from France, but under the condition that at least three of them are manufactured in Greek shipyards. The arms deals are part of a $6 billion procurement program the government in Athens announced in September as tensions with its NATO neighbor, Turkey, soared over oil exploration rights. Greek officials tell VOA both France and Greece chose to seal the ambitious defense agreement on Monday when Greek and Turkish diplomats sat down for the first time in nearly 5 years to resolve differences over sea and air rights in the Aegean. The same officials tell VOA that while Athens supports the ongoing diplomatic process, it will not abandon its plans to upgrade its defenses against its rival, as fears of a breakdown in the talks loom, and with it, a fresh spike in tensions between the two NATO allies. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With thousands of flags whipping in the winter wind, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on the steps of the U.S. Capitol on January 20th. In his inaugural address, President Biden called on all Americans to unite to overcome the nation's challenges and secure its future.
History, faith, and reason show the way of unity. We can see each other not as adversaries, but as neighbors. We can treat each other with dignity and respect. We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature. This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge. And unity is the path forward.
To those beyond the borders of the United States, President Biden also had a message.
We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. We'll be a strong and trusted partner for peace, progress, and security.
Later that day, President Biden took several executive actions with those goals in mind. One action began the process for the United States to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. Another stopped U.S. withdrawal from the World Health Organization. Another rescinds the ban on travelers from some Muslim-majority countries and others from Africa and elsewhere. Yet another pauses construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall and ends an emergency declaration that helped authorize its funding. In his inauguration address, President Biden called on the people of the United States to start afresh. He challenged them together to write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity and not division. The story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history, that our America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.